Evershine Model Paper 1, page 3, History 1, History of India. Time 3 hours, maximum marks 100. Section A. Mark on the outline map provided 5 centers of Jainism and write a note on the contributions of Jainism. 5 plus 5 equal to 10 marks. Answer. In the map of India, the places marked are Mount Abu, Mathura, Pavapuri, Pataliputra, Vaishali, Rajgriha, Vallabhi, Karkala, Dharmasthala and Shravanabelgola. Mahavir advocated a religion of non-violence which would be accepted by all for the welfare of mankind. The religion which he propagated was non-controversial and understandable. Page 4. The doctrine of non-injury is given a wide extension by attributing souls not only to birds and beasts but also to plants, metal and water. The law of perseverance and patience and mutual understanding are the two other important contributions to the mankind to lead a life of peaceful coexistence, with which it is highly probable to avert the misunderstanding and rivalry, not only among individuals, but among nations as a whole. Though a small community, the Jains contributed much to the South Indian culture and civilization. The Jaina writers played a very significant part in the development of vernacular languages such as Tamil and Kannada. Pampa, Pona, Ranna were outstanding poets in the Kannada literature. Some of the Jain works have been written in Sanskrit also, the credit of which goes to the prominent Jain scholars, namely Haribhadra, Akalanka, Siddhasena, Somnath Bhadra, Swami Kartikeya. Hemachandra was the greatest of all Jaina scholars. His important works are the History of Gujarat and Yoga Shastra. Amarasimha, the author of Amarakosha, was also a Jain. The Jains are prosperous in trade and commerce. They have built dharmashalas, schools, colleges and hospitals in important cities and holy places. Art and architecture. The Jain contribution to art are memorable. Jainism served as a source of inspiration to Jain art and architecture in India. They built many monasteries and temples in various places. For example, Tiger Cave at Udayagiri, Indra Sabha at Ellora, Lakkundi, Palitana, Mount Abu, Karkala, Khajuraho in Bundelkhand, and Adinath Temple in Shravanabelgola. The gigantic statue of Bahubali called Gomateshwara was erected by Chavundaraya, the minister of Rajamalla IV, the Ganga king. Alternate question. Mark on the outline map provided the following places and write their historical importance. Page 5. A. Harappa. B. Ujjain. C. Lothal. D. Sanchi. E. Mahabalipuram. Answer. So these places have been marked on the map. A. Harappa. Harappa is situated on the banks of River Ravi in the Montgomery district of Punjab. It was an important site of Indus Valley civilization. It was discovered by R. B. Dayaram Sahani. The huge granary was excavated here. B. Ujjain. It is located in Madhya Pradesh. Ashoka was the governor of this province. It was the second capital of Chandragupta II, Vikramaditya. C. Lothal. It is in Gujarat. It was an important site of Indus Valley civilization. It was a dockyard where the trade and commerce was carried on during the Indus Valley civilization. D. Sanchi. It is in Madhya Pradesh. It is famous for Buddhist stupa of Ashoka. E. Mahabalipuram. It is situated in Tamil Nadu. It was an important architectural center of Pallavas. The famous Rathas constructed by them are found here. Page 6. Section B. Answer any three of the following. 3 multiplied by 15 is equal to 45 marks. Question 1. Describe the various literary sources available for the study of Indian history. Answer. History is the chronicle of past events. History is the recreation of past by selecting important events and facts. These facts are found in various forms which are called sources. Sources are the raw materials for the reconstruction of history. They are the traces left behind by man. History, as a subject, is more or less completely at the mercy of the sources. Without sources, a historian is like a fish out of water. Such is the importance of sources. The ancient Indian history is reconstructed based on the availability of sources. Sources of Indian history can be classified into two, literary and archaeological. So we have a diagram. Sources is divided into two, literary and archaeology. Under literary, we have again two types, indigenous and foreign. Under archaeology, we have three, epigraphy, numismatics and monuments. So literary sources are the written records. It is of two types, the indigenous sources and foreign accounts. Indigenous literary sources are the works written by the native people. They are found in different languages like Sanskrit, Prakrit, Pali, Kannada, etc. Foreign accounts are works written by foreign travelers, ambassadors, etc. Archaeological sources refers to material remains. It consists of inscriptions, coins, monuments, sculptures, paintings, etc. Literary sources. 1. Indigenous accounts. There is plenty of indigenous works on ancient Indian history. It can further be classified as religious books. These are various Brahminical, Buddhist, Jaina religious works which throw light on various conditions of ancient India. Page 7. Brahminical works. There are many Brahminical works which help in reconstructing the early history of India. 1. Vedas. They are the earliest books of Aryans. Although the Vedas are primarily religious books, yet they give information about political, religious and social aspects of the Aryans. There are four Vedas, Rig Veda, Sama Veda, Yajur Veda and Atharva Veda. Rig Veda is the earliest and gives maximum information about Aryans. 2. Brahmanas. They are the prose commentaries written on Samhitas. Samhitas contain Vedic hymns. Aitareya, Satpatha, Gopatha are important Brahmanas. 3. Aranyakas. They are books which have to be studied in forests. 4. Upanishads. They contain philosophical discourses of ancient sages. The above three informs the cultural and religious thoughts of the Aryans. 5. Vedangas or Upavedas. They are special branches of the study. These are the means of understanding of Vedas. They throw light on the contemporary society and religion. They are Shiksha, that is phonetics, Jyotisha, astronomy, Kalpa, ritual, Vyakrana, grammar, Nirukta, etymology, and Chandas, metrics. 6. Sutras, the last of Vedic literature. These are texts from different schools which came into being. They devoted themselves to the understanding and study of different branches of Vedas. The Kalpa Sutras are the texts on rituals. The Shrauta Sutras deal with sacrifice. The Grihya Sutras describe domestic rites. Dharma Sutras explain concept of Dharma. And the Sulabha Sutras deal with the dimensions of the places of sacrifice and fire altars. The sutras presents the pictures of social and religious life of ancient Indians. Page 8. 7. Epics. The two great epics of India, Ramayana and Mahabharata, presents the clear picture of the people of these times. They give abundant information about the economic, religious, social and political conditions of the later Aryans. we can understand the polity of the Aryans, know about various dynasties of that period, the concept of dharma, etc. 8. Puranas. They are ancient volumes of the Hindus written in Sanskrit. They contain the most systematic record of Indian historical tradition. They are 18 in number. Vishnu, Vayu, Brahma, Bhagavata, Matsya have great significance from the historical point of view. They throw light on the different aspects of Indian culture and the political history till 4th century AD. Buddhist works. The Buddhist religious works also throw light on ancient Indian history. They are 1. Tripitakas, consisting of the Vinaya, Sutta and Abhidhamma Pitaka. The Vinaya Pitaka includes the rules and regulations to be followed by the monks in the monasteries. Sutta Pitaka contains the gist of teachings of Lord Buddha. The Abhidhamma Pitaka deals with the philosophical doctrines of Buddhism. 2. Jataka Tales. It deals with the previous lives of Buddha. It has as many as 549 Gospels on the life of Buddha. These stories throw light on the contemporary social, religious and economic conditions. 3. Other Buddhist works. Some other Buddhist works also furnish important information on Indian history. Page 9. They are Milinda Panha, contains the dialogues between Greek king Menander and the Buddhist saint Nagasena. It provides information on the socio-religious conditions of the times of Menander. The Deepavamsa and Mahavamsa, the two Ceylonese chronicles, throw light on Mauryan period. All these books have been written in Pali. The Buddhist scholar Nagarjuna wrote Satta Sahrika, Prajna Paramita and Mahayana Sutras. Ashwaghosha wrote Buddha Charita, Sutra Lankara and Saundarya Nandakavya. Vasubandhu wrote Abhidharmakosha. Asanga wrote Mahayana Sutra Lankara and the other Buddhist works Divya Vandan, Manjushri Mulkalpa and Lalita Vistar are historically important. It describes the contemporary society. A lot of information about Ashoka, Kanishka we get from these books. Jaina books. They are also of great value for ancient Indian history. The Angas and Upangas impart the teachings of Lord Mahavira. The Parishishta Parvan, written by Hemachandra, is important from the historical point of view. Other books are Bhadrabahu Charitra, Lok Vibhaga, etc. A. Secular Literature. Apart from religious books, there are some other works which provide information about contemporary political, social and economic aspects of ancient India. 1. Kautilya or Chanakya. The Prime Minister of Chandragupta Maurya wrote Arthashastra. It is a book on statecraft. Page 10. This is the most authentic book providing information on the Mauryas. It provides information about contemporary administrative system. It was regarded as a manual for administrators and politicians. 2. Mudra Rakshasa, a play written by Vishakadatta. It accounts the downfall of Nandas and the coming into power of Chandragupta Maurya through the efforts of Chanakya. 3. Works of Kalidasa. He has written plays, lyrics and epics. His works throw light on the social and religious life of the people during the Gupta age. He is called as the Prince of Poets and a great dramatist of Indian literature. Raghuvamsha, Malavikagnimitra, Ritusamhara, Abhignana, Shakuntala, Vikramur Vanshyam, etc. 4. Harsha Charita of Banabhatta is historically important because it gives enough information regarding all main events of the Harshas period. 5. Mahabhashya of Patanjali, a Sanskrit grammarian, makes references to the republics and the Mauryan period. He also describes the Greek invasion. 6. Ashtadhyayi of Panini, also a Sanskrit grammarian, refers about the republics of ancient India. 7. Raja Tarangini of Kalhana informs the history of Kashmir from the legendary origin till the middle of 12th century. 8. Vikramanka Deva Charita of Bilhana describes about the Chalukya dynasty. 9. Prithviraj Raso, written by Chand Bardai, has important material on Prithviraj Chauhan. 10. Nagananda Ratnavali and Priyadarshika of Harshavardhana informs about socio-religious conditions of his times. Page 11. The other important works are Buddha Charitra and Saundarya Nanda Kavya of Nagarjuna and Mahavibhasa Sutra of Vasumitra. It tells us about Kanishka and Buddhism. The works of Bhasa, Swapna Vasavadatta, Pratigna Yogandharayana, Shudraka's Mrichchakatika, Bhairavi's Kiratarjuneya, Dandin's Kavya Darsha and Dashakumara Charita, all written during the Gupta period, gives information about Guptas. Scientific works. In the field of science, two Indians achieved a great success and stood first in astronomy. Aryabhatta wrote Surya Siddhanta, which explains the eclipses. Varaha Meera's Brihat Samhita, Brahmagupta's Brahma Siddhanta are other books about astronomy and mathematics. There was intense literary activity in South India also. Some of the rulers belonging to different dynasties were themselves scholars who contributed to the field of literature. Hala, the Satavahana ruler, wrote Gatha Saptasati. Amoghavarsha Nripatunga, the greatest Rashtrakuta ruler, wrote Kavi Rajamarga. Durvinita wrote a commentary on the 15th canto of Bhairavi's Kiratarjuneya and translated Gunadhyaya's Brihat Katha to Sanskrit language. Someshwara III, the Kalyani Chalukyan ruler, wrote Abhilasha Shiratha Chintamani, Manolasa. Mahendra Varma I wrote Matta Vilasa. Prasanna Krishna Devaraya wrote Amukta Malayada, a work on polity. The Sangam literature is an important source to know the history and culture of Cholas, Cheras and Pandyas, which flourished during that period. Some of them are Tolkapiyami of Tolkapiyar, Tirukural of Tiruvallur, the two Tamil epics, Silapadikaram and Mani Meghalaya, Ettutogai Pattupattu. Many of the writings of the Alvars, that is the Vaishnava saints, and Nayanmars, that is the Shaiva saints, and the exponents of Advaita philosophy of Shankaracharya, Vishishtadvaita of Ramanujacharya, Dvaita of Madhavacharya, and Shakti Vishishtadvaita of Basavanna informs about the socio-religious conditions of their times. Page 12. Thus, all these accounts of various scholars help in reconstructing the ancient Indian history and solving a number of problems regarding the history. Foreign sources. From time to time, many foreign travelers, pilgrims, ambassadors and visitors came to India and have left behind the accounts of their observations about Indian life and culture. The accounts in these books provide information about the prevailing economic, social, political and religious conditions of Indian history. Although most of such works and accounts are not available now, those which are available now are sometimes not completely authentic. Still, these accounts throw light upon Indian history. These accounts provided information on those subjects which Indian sources are silent upon. These are important while ordering Indian history chronologically. Greek accounts. The Greeks have provided valuable information to reconstruct Indian history. The most important Greek writer is Herodotus. He has thrown light on the political connections between Indian border states and Achaemenid Empire in the 5th century BC. Tesias has also written about India in his work. Scylax, a navigator, was sent by Darius, wrote on a voyage to find the course of Indus. Apart from them, many writers came with Alexander who have also written about India. The most important was Nearchus, Aristobulus, Arrian and Vancicritus. Although their works are not available now, they have been quoted by writers which give information about Alexander's invasion to India. Arrian has described about Alexander's invasion based on the accounts of Nearchus, admiral of Alexander's fleet. Page 13. The Greeks sent their ambassadors to the Mauryan courts. Most important were Megasthenes, Diamachos, and Dionysius. Seleucus Nicator sent Megasthenes to the court of Chandragupta Maurya. His work Indica was a comprehensive work on India, describing the country, climate, flora and fauna, religion and politics. The original work has been lost. Some of the later writers have quoted passages from Indica. Indica consisted of 4 volumes. Diamachos was sent from the Syrian court to the court of Bindusara. The later Greek and Roman writers like Strabo, Diodorus, Arrian, Pliny, Ptolemy, etc. were more rational and highly critical. Ptolemy's Geography and Pliny's Natural History are also very important books. These books give information about India's trade with Rome. Chinese accounts. They are also as important as Greek ones. Su Ma Chen was the first historian from China who wrote on India in 1st century BC. Apart from him, Fa Hian, Yu Tsitang visited India. These have written interesting accounts of their visits and have described about social, economic, political conditions and education of contemporary India. They were greatly attracted by Buddhism. They started visiting India since 399 AD. Muslim sources. The accounts of Muslim travelers are also important to study Indian history. Among these travelers, Al-Biruni is most notable because he knew Sanskrit as well. He wrote Tehqeeq-e-Hind. He had come to India with Muhammad Ghazni. Other Muslim travelers were Suleiman Al-Masudi, Ibn Battuta, Nizamuddin. Nizami also wrote memoirs giving information about the conditions of India. Thus, it is clear that the accounts of these foreign travelers throw light upon Indian geography and its political, religious, social and economic conditions and are helpful in solving a number of problems regarding history. Page 14. Question 2. Give an account of the life in the Rig Vedic civilization. Answer. The most ancient and earliest literature of the Aryans is the Rig Veda. The period when Rig Veda was written is called the Rig Vedic Age or the Early Vedic Age. Rig Veda throws enough light on the then social, economic, religious and political conditions of the Aryan civilization. A. Political life or political conditions. The Rig Veda gives sufficient information about the contemporary political condition. The smallest unit of Rig Vedic political system was the family. It was called Kula. The eldest male member was the head of the family called Kulappa. A collection of many families formed a village or a grama. The head of the grama was Gramani. A group of many villages form a visha, which was headed by Vishapati. Many vishas made a jana. Gopa was the chief of a jana. A number of janas formed a rashtra, headed by Rajan. The whole country or the kingdom was called the rashtra. Monarchy was a form of government, though republican states were also not unknown. Kingship was hereditary, but there are references in Rig Veda which denotes that at times when need arose, people could select a monarch of their choice from the royal family. The main and most sacred duty of the king was to protect the people from enemies and work for their welfare. In return, the people had to respect the king, and they used to pay him tax called Balihit. The kings were not dictators. There were certain checks upon his powers. They had to take an oath during the coronation ceremony to work for the people's prosperity. If he violated, the people could elect another king. King was assisted by a number of officers in the administration of the kingdom. They were the Purohita, Senani, Gramini, and the village assemblies, Sabha and Samiti. Page 15. The Purohita gave advice to the king. He was to be the main companion to the king, who had to work as a teacher, guide, and friend for the king. He was also his spiritual guru. Apart from participating in all religious rites of the royal family, he took part in politics also. He went with the king in battles and prayed for his success. Purohita was an essential part of the contemporary political setup. Senani was the commander-in-chief of the army. He was elected by the king. His duties were to carry out attacks on other kingdom and defend the kingdom from external attacks. The two bodies, Sabha and Samiti, could impose restrictions upon the king. Rig Veda mentions these two as the daughters of Prajapati. There is difference in opinion regarding the differences between the two bodies and their works. According to Ludwig, Sabha was like the upper house, represented by priests and rich people. The members of the Sabha were very rich. They were men of great wealth and of noble birth. Therefore, it was probably a council of the elders or the nobles. The meetings of the Sabha took place in an assembly hall. Both political and non-political matters were discussed. Dr. Altaker, A.S., is of the opinion that Sabha was a village or clan assembly, meeting for social and political purposes. Samiti was another important organ of the period. It was the national assembly of the people. During its sessions, the people were expected to be present. The representatives of the entire population of the tribe or kingdom, that is, Brahmins, rich people, heads of aristocratic family, and representatives of common people. The presence of the king was essential in the Samiti. Its function included the election of the king, deposing the king, protection of the kingdom, creation of harmonious condition. It was a powerful organ of Vedic polity. The Sabha and Samiti were two important bodies of the Vedic administrative system. The power of the king was limited and controlled by it. Page 16. The king was the fountainhead of justice. The king was above the law. He wielded the rod of punishment, that is danda, but he himself was above punishment. Capital punishment was given for serious crimes. Imprisonment and fines were imposed for ordinary crimes. Trial by order was the most powerful method of justice, which used hot oil, fire and water. Purohita was there for his help. B. Social life, social conditions. The Rig Veda throws light on the social life of that period. Their social life was very simple, sacred and smooth. 1. Family. It was a fundamental or the lowest unit of the Aryan society. The patriarchal family could be seen in their social organization. The head of the family used to be the eldest male member. He could be the grandfather, father, or the eldest son. The other members of the society had to follow the commands of the head of the family. He exercised power and authority over them. There used to be cordial relationship between him and other members of the family. But Rig Veda refers to certain instances where the father punished the son or the members of the family for their wrongs. Joint family system existed. Father, being the head of the family, was known as Grihapati and Dampati. He used to perform all religious ceremonies along with his wife. Hospitality was a salient feature and guests were treated warmly. 2. Status of women. During this age, women were held in high esteem. In every sphere of life, they enjoyed equality with men. The wife was accorded special importance and respect. No religious rites could be performed by the husbands without the presence of their wife. The wife had the responsibility of carrying out all the houseworks. There is no evidence to show that women had a subordinate position. She occupied an equal place with men in intellectual and spiritual life. Women were not deprived of a right to education. They received similar education as men and often took part in philosophical debates. Page 17. The Rigveda mentions the names of learned women like Lopamudra, Sikata, Appala, Ghosha, Nivavasi, Vishwavara, who composed hymns like the male rishis. They attained the titles of rishis. Many educated women also became distinguished poetesses. Women also had a sound knowledge of music and dance. Marriage was supposed to be a holy and religious work. It was considered a sacrament and not a contract. Life was supposed to be incomplete without marriage. Girls were married when they had attained full maturity. The marriages were normally performed according to the wish of the parents. The Swayamvara system developed during the later ages and women were given the right to choose their partners. Monogamy was the usual practice, but polygamy was in vogue among the kings and members of the royal family and great chiefs. Polyandry was unknown. Parda system and practice of sati were unknown. Widows were permitted to marry again. The word dampati was used for the mistress and master of the house. The sons used to be the heir to the father's property, but in the case of no son, the daughter had the right. Thus, women occupied an important place in the social and religious gatherings. She was held in great respect both at home and outside at that period. 3. Caste system. There is a lot of difference of opinion on the existence of the caste system. Some scholars, on the basis of the Purusha Sukta of the Rig Veda, prove the existence of caste system. This Sukta says that the Brahmins sprang from the head of Brahma, the Kshatriyas from his arms, the Vaishyas from his thighs, and Shudras from his feet. Some scholars say that the Purusha Sukta was added later. The form of caste system was not so rigid as it became afterwards. It was based upon the karma rather than the birth. Page 18. 4. Food and drinks. The main food of the Aryans was milk, curd, butter and ghee, but they consumed fruits, vegetables and cereals also. They took meat and drank somras and wine, though it was not very common. At the time of religious ceremonies and sacrifices, the intoxicating juice of a plant called soma was taken, though it was condemned in the Rig Veda. 5. Dress and ornaments. The Aryans used to wear the dress made of cotton, wool and skin of animals. The garments consisted of three main parts, nivi, an undergarment, adhivasa, an upper garment, and vasa, worn on lower part of the body, which can be compared to the dhoti. The garments of the rich were embroidered with gold. The saints generally used to wear the skins of deer. Both men and women used ornaments. Earrings were used by both men and women. Armlets, anklets and necklaces were used by women only. 6. Amusement. Chariot racing, dicing, dancing and hunting were favorite pastimes. In spite of the popularity of gambling, it was condemned by Rig Veda. Aryans were fond of music. Both recital and singing were in use. They used to play the flute, dhol, manjira. 7. Education. Both physical and spiritual education was given to the students in the ashrams. The aim of education was the sharpening of the intellect, developing of character, and achievement of the highest knowledge. Generally, religious education was imparted. Many scholars believe that they did not know writing. C. Religious life. The Aryans' religion was simple and plain. People had a great respect for nature. Gods mentioned in Rig Veda are symbols of the powers manifested in nature. Page 19. Prayers and sacrifices held vital places in their religion, as they were supposed to be the best means to please the gods. There was no priestly class. The head of the family himself discharged the duties of a priest, like lighting of the sacrificial fire and the chanting of the hymns. There existed no temples or idols made. The Aryans were worshippers of nature. Wherever they would find beauty or power, they vested them with supernatural or divine character and created God there. Rig Veda mentions that there were 33 gods who were divided into three groups. The celestial gods were Varuna, the lord of all waters, Mitra, a solar deity, Surya, the sun, Savitri, the god who provided mukti from bad dreams and evil spirits, Aditi, the god who provided mukti from all worldly bonds, Usha, the goddess of dawn, etc. The aerial or atmospheric gods, Indra, the god of the rain, storm and lightning. He occupied a chief place among the Vedic gods. He is supposed to be the owner of the sky, earth, water and mountains. He held the Vajrayudha and was the destroyer of forts. He was worshipped for victory in battles. They also worshipped Rudra, one of the most angered gods. A slight defect in his worshipping made him angry. Vayu was the god of wind, and Marut, who aided Indra in many ways, were the storm gods. Terrestrial gods were Agni. The fire god holds second place to Indra. The importance of Agni was increased because of the yagnas and havans. The Ahutis were sent to gods through Agni. Soma was the lord of plants. People used to drink somras, which made them ecstatic. Therefore, people worshipped him because they thought God was present in it. Prithvi, the mother earth, Saraswati, the goddess of learning. Rig Veda does not mention animal worship. Kings and aristocrats performed grand sacrifices with elaborate rituals and costly offerings to the gods. Page 20. People were not afraid of gods. They were rather on friendly terms with the concept of God. They believed God could not do them wrong. The essential nature of the Vedic gods was benevolence. When the gods were pleased by sacrifices, they would bestow happiness on the people, protect the people from evils, and contribute to their prosperity. The philosophy of the Aryans showed that the men did not retire to forests and subject themselves to hard penance. The world was not considered as an evil place of misery. There was no eagerness to get rid of the body and escape from the shackles of this world. To them, it was a good world. They wanted to enjoy life in this world to the full. The Rig Vedic rishis conceived this world as a fit place for virtuous men to lead a good life under the protect of gods. There was no conflict between man's future and his present, no conflict between dharma, artha and kama. Man's life was conceived as a harmonious unit. The theory of rebirth was not completely formed. The dead body was set on fire and ash and bones were collected, washed and buried in an urn. The Rig Vedic ideas of life after death were very vague. The soul departed to the Pitruloka, the land of fathers, where it was received by Yama, the king of dead, and rewarded or punished according to its deeds. In course of time, the views of the Aryans about the nature and the divinity changed. They soon realized that God exists and He is the creator of all creation in the universe. The Rigvedic hymns reflect the idea of universal unity and express the belief that God is one, although he is called by several names. Thus, the idea of a single supreme power governing and controlling the universe seems to have realized. They had the knowledge of one Satya, that is one reality, though they worshipped many gods. D. Economic life or economic conditions. Agriculture was the main occupation of Rig Vedic Aryans. It was carried on with the help of bulls and oxen. The ploughed land was called Urvara or Kshetra. Water was got from wells, lakes and canals. Page 21. Cattle rearing was another important occupation. The wealth of the people was known in terms of cattle. The Rigvedic Aryans resorted to hunting for livelihood, sport and the protection of their flock from wild animals. Simple professions like carpentry, pottery, metalwork, weaving, etc. existed. Barter system was in vogue. Trade was carried on with other countries, and naturally there must have been some system of exchange. Question 3. Discuss the religious policy of Ashoka. Ashoka was the greatest ruler of the Mauryan dynasty. The Kalinga War was an important event in the life of Ashoka. After this war, the whole outlook of Ashoka was revolutionized. This war left a deep impact on the personal life and the religion of Ashoka. The Kalinga War filled the king with deep regrets that he sought to change for the wrongs done. He was influenced by the principle of Buddhism and became its follower. Many scholars believe that the religion propagated by Ashoka was not Buddhism. They support the following arguments. We hear nothing concerning the deeper ideals of Buddhism. There is no mention of the four great truths, the eightfold path, the karma theory, the idea of nirvana. But strong proofs are available that Ashoka was a Buddhist. They are Deepavamsa, Mahavamsa, Kalhana's Rajatarangini, the accounts of Yunsi Tsang, Fahyan, Itsing, and the first and the eighth rock edicts, etc. Ashoka became a Buddhist in the ninth year of his accession. The eighth rock edict says that Kalinga War had taken place in the eighth year of his accession. He took numerous steps to propagate and spread Buddhism. Page 22. They are A. Religious or Dharma Yatras. Ashoka started going on religious yatras in the place of the Vihara Yatras for hunting and other sports. In the eighth rock edict, he mentions that the aims behind these yatras were to have the darshan of sadhus and brahmins, to give them presents, to have the darshan of old people, and to distribute gold among them, to teach and preach them religion, and to hold discussions with them. Ashoka undertook the dharma yatras and devoted himself to the moral upliftment of the people. He visited various places connected with the life of Lord Buddha, that is Lumbini, Kapilavastu, Sarnath, etc. The examples of Ashoka inspired his subjects to follow Buddhism. B. Dhamma Vijaya. After the fierce battle of Kalinga, Ashoka had come to despise wars and bloodshed. He then abandoned the policy of wars and adopted the policy of Dhamma Vijaya to propagate Buddhism. C. Spread of non-violence. Ashoka not only adopted but also propagated the chief Buddhist principle of non-violence. He himself gave up hunting and meat eating. He prohibited the killing of many animals and birds. This he ordered in the 26th year of his reign in his fifth pillar edict. D. Religious preachings. According to the seventh pillar edict, Ashoka frequently went to the people and preached religion among them. He directly contacted people and spread religion among them. E. Establishing religion department. Ashoka established a religion department and appointed various officials. The third rock edict shows that he had ordered various classes of officers to undertake inspection and tours every 5 years to ensure the principles of dharma were being observed. Page 23. Some of the officers were required to give moral instructions to the people. They were Rajukas, Pradesikas and Yuktas, etc. These officers also performed their allotted duties in addition to the imparting of moral instructions. But Ashoka was not satisfied with them and appointed special officers called Dharma Mahamatras. The fifth rock edict says Ashoka appointed them in the 13th year of his reign. They were for all religions and sects. They did not belong to Buddhism alone, but from all religions. Their duty is to look after the religions and to see the prosperity of those who follow the religion. They will look after all religions and religious places. Though the rock edict says that the Dharma Mahamatras were taken from all religions, but generally they belonged to Buddhist religion. They did a commendable job of propagating Buddhism and the moral uplift of the people. F. Work for others' welfare. Ashoka wanted to give a practical shape to the Dhamma. For this, he did many works for the welfare of others. The seventh pillar edict says that Ashoka planted trees on roads whose shade will be helpful to men and animals. He got planted many mango gardens, dug wells, built rest houses, opening of hospitals both for men and animals, etc. This greatly strengthened the faith of the people in the principles of morality and humanity preached by Ashoka. G. Dhamma Lipi and inscriptions. To spread Buddhism, Ashoka inscribed various orders and preachings on rocks, pillars and caves. These inscriptions were carried out in the language of the region so that they could be easily followed by the people. H. Building stupas and viharas. Ashok built a number of stupas and viharas where monks lived and preached religion, which helped the spread of Buddhism. Page 24. I. Dhamma Dana. Ashoka arranged for Dhamma Dana in place of simple Dana. In the second rock edict, he says that through Dhamma Dana, a man not only gets happiness in this world, but also in the next. J. Third Buddhist Conference. Ashoka rendered a great service to the cause of Buddhism by convening the Third Buddhist Council held at Pataliputra. Moggaliputta Tishya presided over it. The council made a new classification of Buddhist texts by adding a third Pitaka known as Abhidhamma Pitaka. The council discussed over various crises that Buddhism was facing. It also decided to send Buddhist missionaries for the propagation of Buddhism in different parts of India, Sri Lanka and West Asia. K. Spread of Buddhism in foreign lands. Ashoka sent a number of missionaries for the propagation of Buddhism to foreign lands. Rock Edict 13 says that Ashoka believes the Dhamma Vijaya is the most vital one. It shows that he not only conquered his empire, but also neighboring ones through Dhamma Vijaya. This shows that Dhamma spread from India, Sri Lanka to Syria, Egypt, Macedonia and many Greek islands. Similarly, Rock Edict 2 and 5 also make mentions of the states where Ashoka sent missions and Dhamma Mahamatras. It is known from Deepavamsa, Mahavamsa, and other works that after the Third Buddhist Council, messengers were sent to Lanka, North Canara, Mysore, Kashmir, Gandhara, Western India, Maharashtra and Greek kingdoms. Ashoka sent his son and daughter Mahendra and Sangamitra to Sri Lanka, where they successfully spread Buddhism and made 1,000 of Buddhist followers. Some scholars believe that Ashoka tried to spread Buddhism in Burma. Kalhana's Rajatarangini shows that Buddhism was propagated in Kashmir. Deepavamsa tells that Ashoka and his daughter Charumati had gone to Nepal to spread Buddhism and built a chaitya and some stupas. Page 25. Thus, Ashoka did the above mentioned works to spread Buddhism. He was successful in the 14 years of his reign in propagating Buddhism to its full. Question 4. Describe the achievements of Samudragupta. Answer. Samudragupta, 335-380 AD. He was undoubtedly the greatest king of the Gupta dynasty. He was the son of Chandragupta I. If his father was credited with the founding of the Gupta Empire, he was responsible for making it a paramount power in the whole of northern India. The information about this king comes primarily from the Allahabad pillar inscription composed by Hari Sena and issued by Samudragupta. It gives us a detailed account of the career and personality of Samudragupta and his various conquests. Conquests. Having made his position secure, he planned a Digvijaya. Digvijaya was the ultimate goal of his life. When he became the king, India was divided into a number of small kingdoms. Samudragupta made up his mind to conquer all such kingdoms and establish a vast empire so that political unity of the country might be achieved. It was owing to his military achievements that V. A. Smith has called him as the Indian Napoleon. Conquests of the North. The Allahabad inscription says that there were 9 kingdoms in North India or Aryavarta. He says that he led into 2 North Indian or Aryavarta expeditions. In the first attack, he defeated 3 rulers of North India, Achyutanga, Nagasena, and Ganapati Naga. The portions containing the description of the kings after Nagasena has been destroyed and only Ga has been read. Scholars believe that Ganapati Naga was written there. After defeating these 3 rulers, Samudragupta led an expedition to the south. At that time, these kings revolted against Samudragupta. Page 26. Moreover, some other rulers of Aryavarta also started to revolt with these rulers. Samudragupta made a second attack on North India and subdued all the 9 kings of Aryavarta. The Allahabad inscription gives the names of the 9 kings. 1. Rudradeva. 2. Matila. 3. Nagadatta. 4. Chandravarman. 5. Ganpati Naga. 6. Nagasena. 7. Achyuta. 8. Nandiyan. And 9. Balavarman. Samudragupta not only defeated them but also captured their kingdoms. Conquest of South. After consolidating his empire in North, he next turned his attention towards South. He attacked the southern states, not with a view of annexing the southern regions. He knew fully well that these places, being far from his capital, would be difficult to control both the North and the South at the same time. It was due to this fact that he did not annex the conquered territories of the South to his empire. It can be said that he adopted the policy of Digvijaya in the North, while the policy of Dharmavijaya was adopted in the South. He defeated 12 rulers in the South. His aim was to make the kings to accept the rule of the Gupta dynasty. All the conquered territories were restored to the respective rulers. These rulers acknowledged the suzerainty of Samudragupta. These kings also agreed to pay him annual tributes. The names of the rulers defeated by Samudragupta have been given in the Allahabad Prashasti. 1. Mahendra of Kosala. 2. Vyagra Raja of Mahakantara. 3. Mantraja of Koral. 4. Swamidatta of Kottura. 5. Damana of Irandapulla. 6. Vishnugopa of Kanchi. 7. Nilaraja of Avamukta. 8. Hastivarman of Vengi. 9. Ugrasena of Pallakka. 10. Kuvera of Devarashtra. 11. Dhanajaja of Kushalapura. And 12. Mahendragiri of Pishtapura. Page 27. Conquests of the Atavika States. The territory extending from the district of Ghazipur, UP to the district of Jabalpur, MP was called the Atavika States or the Forest Territories. Samudragupta compelled the rulers of the wild tribes of these provinces, who were 18 in number, to acknowledge his suzerainty. He achieved success in this campaign. As a result, Samudragupta could easily establish a direct contact between the north and the south. Conquest of frontier states. The Allahabad Prashanti describes the conquest of Samudragupta frontier states. The rulers of frontier states over surrendered and agreed to pay annual tribute to the emperor. They were 1. Samatata, southeast Bengal. 2. Devaka, this territory has not been identified. 3. Kamarupa, Assam. 4. Nepal. 5. Kartarpur, probably territory included the district of Kumau, Gadwal and Rohilkhand. The Allahabad Prashanti mentions the word Adi after Kartarpur. There are some other states besides these 5 states. These states also accepted his suzerainty. Suppression of the Republican states. The Allahabad Prashanti says that Samudragupta also suppressed 9 states of the western frontier and brought them under his rule. The tribes who lived in the states suppressed by Samudragupta were 1. Malavas, 2. Arjunayans, 3. Yaudheyas, 4. Madrakas, 5. Abhiras, 6. Prajjunas, 7. Sanakanikas, 8. Kakas, 9. Kharparikas. Relations with foreign rulers. Some foreign dynasties, such as the Kushanas, Shakas, Sahis, etc., were impressed by the conquest of Samudragupta and sent their ambassadors with offers of friendship. Page 28. Samudragupta established friendly relations with them. He also had cordial relations with the Sri Lankan ruler Meghavarman. Meghavarman built a monastery at Bodh Gaya with the permission of Samudragupta. Due to his conquests, the empire extended from Himalayas in the north to river Narmada in the south, from Brahmaputra in the east to Chambal in the west. To commemorate his conquest, he performed an Ashwamedha Yagna. He adopted the title of Maharajadhiraja or King of Kings. Samudragupta was also a patron of art and literature. He himself was a great musician and a poet of high order. Some of his coins show him as playing an instrument similar to the veena. He also composed many poems, and thus he adopted the title of Kaviraj or King of Poets. Many learned scholars lived in his court. Harisena, who composed the Allahabad Prashanti, was the ablest. Buddhist scholars Vasubandhu and Asanga also were in his court. Samudragupta also had issued gold coins. In most of his coins, he is shown carrying bow and arrow and aiming at a tiger or deer. In others, he is shown as sprinkling incense at the altar. He had muscular arms and fully developed chest. Some of his coins show a horse standing near a sacrificial pit, indicating his Ashwamedha Yagna. He also issued coins which were engraved with the title Ashwamedha Parakrama on the rivers of the coins. Samudragupta was a staunch follower of Hinduism. He performed Ashwamedha Yagna. He thus revived Brahmanism. In spite of his belief in Hinduism, he was sympathetic to all religions. It may be concluded that Samudragupta was a great warrior, a scholar, a poet, musician, diplomat and a statesman. Page 29. His conquests prove his skill in the battlefield. He ranks among the greatest conquerors of the world. Though he was called Indian Napoleon, he had never seen the defeat of Napoleon at Waterloo. He was never defeated in his life. Question 5. Explain the administration of Cholas. Answer. The Cholas evolved a highly systemized and well-organized administration. Central government. Monarchy was the form of government. The king was the supreme head of the state. He enjoyed supreme absolute powers. His main duty was to maintain law and order in the country. The kings assumed various titles to assert their sovereign position. He was the commander-in-chief of the army. He was also in charge of external affairs. Kingship was hereditary. The king appointed Yuvaraja, the future successor. The king held tours to check the work of administration as it promoted efficiency in administration. The king was the fountainhead of justice. The Chola kings performed Ashwamedha and other sacrifices. They also liberally donated to the temples. Thus, the king's position was highly respectable. He was the pivot on which the entire administration stood. Though the king enjoyed absolute powers, he was assisted by a council of ministers. These ministers advised him in the administrative work. They also advised him on some critical issues. It was, however, left to the king to accept their advice and act according to it. These ministers represented the chief departments of administration. The Cholas also maintained a well-organized civil service or bureaucracy to carry on the administrative work. These officials were of different grades. This was the most important feature of the Chola administration. Page 30. Provincial administration. The Chola kingdom was divided into provinces known as mandalams. These mandalams were looked after by a viceroy or governor. The viceroys were appointed by the king and was responsible to him. Normally, the viceroys were appointed from royal families. Even the princes acted as viceroys. They received king's orders, implemented and reported the actions. He was in constant communication with the king. The mandalas were divided into kottams or presidencies and then into valanadus or districts. These were subdivided into nadus, identical with taluks. Kurrams or villages was the lowest unit of administration. The Cholas followed the decentralization of power. We find a democratic spirit in their way of administration. Besides the ministers, there were four popular assemblies to look after the work of administration. The Chola rulers achieved the power and prestige through these assemblies. They are 1. The Nattar. This assembly was meant to look after the affairs of the district or the Nattar. The district-wise problems were settled here. Problems were resolved then and there. 2. Nagaratta. This assembly had the power to watch the matters of cities and towns. It mainly supervised trade and commerce. 3. Ur. It was the village assembly which met the demands of the people of the village. 4. Sabha. It was a separate assembly of Brahmins. Ur and Sabha are dealt in detail under village administration. Refer village administration from. The Cholas evolved a highly systemized and well-organized administration. Monarchy was the form of government. The king was the head of the government. Though the Chola kings enjoyed absolute powers, they adopted the policy of decentralization. They introduced a democratic spirit in their way of administration, which can be seen in the administration of villages. Page 31. The administration of villages was the most striking feature of the Chola administration. The center did not interfere in the village administration. There was complete freedom in the administration of villages, which not only relieved the burden of the center, at the same time popularized the administration. There were two types of village assemblies, Ur and Sabha or the Mahasabha. Ur was the general type of assembly which could be found in every ordinary village. Such ordinary village consisted of all the people. Sabha or Mahasabha was the assembly found in the Brahmadeya villages. The Brahmadeya villages were agraharas granted by the kings to learned Brahmins. The Uttaramerur inscription of Parantaka 1 gives us an account of the functioning of the village assembly. According to it, each village consisted of 30 wards or kudumbos. Each ward was to nominate some persons. The candidate had to possess certain qualifications. They were: 1. The candidate had to own more than 1/4 veli of land. Veli, about an acre and a half. 2. Residence in a house built on one's own site. 3. Age between 35 and 70. 4. He should have knowledge of one Veda and one Bhashya. 5. His mind should be pure. There were some disqualifications that prohibited a person from contesting elections. They were: 1. He should not have been a member of any committee for the past 3 years. Page 32. 2. Those who had been in charge of any committee and had failed to give accounts. 3. He should not have acquired property by dishonest means. 4. Those who were guilty of the 5 great sins of theft and adultery, social and religious offences of different kinds, and foolhardiness. 5. Those who had killed a Brahmana. 6. Those who had plundered others' property. 7. Those who indulged in intoxicating drinks. 8. Those who had committed sins and had purified by performing ceremonies. 9. Those who committed adultery with the wife of a spiritual teacher. 10. Those who had committed forgery were not eligible. Measures were taken to ensure fair elections. The elections were conducted in the temple hall. The king nominated the chief presiding officer, called a Madhyastha. Every voter was given a voting paper of palm leaf tickets called Volai. After the voters had mentioned the candidates of their choice on the Volai, the papers were collected and put into a sealed pot called Kudavolai. From among the persons duly nominated, one was to be chosen for each of the 30 wards or kudumbas by Kudavolai. An old man would shake the pot well, and a child would be asked to take out as many tickets as there were members to be chosen. The tickets picked up by the boy were handed over to the Madhyastha. This officer read out the name on the voting paper and declared him as elected. The 30 members so elected organized themselves into committees called Variyams. The number of committees and the members varied from village to village. However, 3 important committees were mentioned, namely: 1. The annual committee or Samvat Saravariyam. 2. The garden committee or the Tottavariyam. And 3. The tank committee or the Irivariyam. Page 33. The annual committee consisted of 12 members, the garden committee of 12, and the tank committee of 6 members. The members of these committees were called Variya Peru Makkal. Apart from these, the standing committee, gold committee, and Panchwara committee were also selected. For the Panchavariyam and the Ponavariyam, that is a committee for the supervision of gold, 30 persons were elected from 30 wards. The members were elected only for 1 year. Members were paid nothing for their services. Generally, the assembly met in the village temple, but sometimes it met under the shade of a tree or on the bank of a tank. Village assemblies were entrusted with the entire management of the village. It performed almost all administrative functions. It maintained village lands and was responsible for collecting the total amount of revenue to the government. The village assemblies also administered justice. It also looked into accounts. Only honest men were permitted to write accounts. The person who wrote the accounts had to submit the declaration of his wealth to the men of the big committee of accounts. Only then he was considered for the post next time. Not only that person who wrote the accounts had to complete and submit the accounts himself. No other person would be permitted to close the accounts. Such regulations were made by Parantaka I to enhance the efficiency of the village administration. Precautions were also taken to prevent the monopoly of power by any officer. The village assembly also made provisions for education. It helped the people in times of famine or scarcity. It provided them with means of subsistence. Sometimes it borrowed from the treasury of the village temple for that purpose. The village assemblies acted as trustees for public charities of all kinds. They received deposits of money, land and paddy on the condition that they provided the things stipulated by the donors. Page 34. These functions were the supplying of rice to the god of the temple, supply of paddy to specific persons, maintenance of flower gardens, and provision of water and fire pans to Brahmins. It also preserved the law and order and supervised the endowments and public charities. It was also its duty to maintain local religions and charitable institutions. It regulated the market and assigned particular places for the sale of particular commodities. It could regularly impose taxes and even levy extra tolls for specific objects of public utility. It also acted as custodian of local banks. Many works of public utility were undertaken. The Garden Supervision Committee was in charge of keeping roads in order and repair them whenever necessary. The Tank Supervision Committee was in charge of constructing the tank and removing the silt from it. It looked after the irrigation works. It had full powers to buy land for irrigation purposes. It levied taxes for the maintenance of irrigation works. Above all, it protected the village from external attack. It gave reward to those who rendered meritorious services by saving the people from them. Thus, the village assemblies possessed practically absolute authority over the affairs of the village. They were generally left undisturbed by the central governments. The village assemblies were responsible for the payment of taxes due for the village. On one occasion, the members of a village assembly were arrested and imprisoned for unpaid balance of royal revenue. In one inscription, it is stated that the royal officers supervised the accounts of village assemblies from time to time. The assemblies were fined for its negligence in the performance of its duties. In one case, the king fined an assembly on the complaint brought by the temple authorities that it was misappropriating a part of revenue assigned to them. The assembly could also bring to the notice of the king any misdeed of any servant of any temple. Some of the regulations passed by the assembly required the sanction of the king. Capital punishments were confirmed by the king. Page 35. Any royal charter affecting the status of a village had to be sent for approval to the village assembly before it was registered and sent to the record office. There were frequent references of cordial relations between the assemblies and the king. Many inscriptions refer to the gifts of land by assemblies for the sake of the health of the king or for celebrating a royal victory. Thus, the development of village autonomy was the most unique feature in the Chola administration. This is undoubtedly a good record of village administration. 10 centuries ago, particularly when we now experience village schemes which are so much less attractive and less beneficial to the people. Section C. Answer any 3 of the following. 3 multiplied by 10 equal to 30 marks. Question 1. Explain the town planning of Indus Valley Civilization. Answer. The Indus Valley Civilization holds an important place in Indian history. It was discovered in the year 1921-22. This civilization was as much developed and ancient as other great civilization and was even superior to them in some fields. Town planning. The chief characteristic feature of Indus Valley civilization was the town planning. The Indus cities were the creation of careful planning. Excavation of sites indicates the urban character of this civilization. The remains of the city makes us feel as if they were built by skilled engineers and architects. Roads. There were broad roads which ran from east to west and from north to south, which cut each other at right angles. Thus, it divided the city into several blocks. The narrow streets which diverged from the roads were 1 meter to 2 meters wide. The main streets were 32 feet wide. There was a 11-meter broad road in Mohenjo-daro, which must have been the royal path. Page 36. All the roads of the city were connected to this road. Trees were planted on the sides of the roads. Platforms were also constructed at places where possibly shops were built. Houses. The straight roads which cut each other at right angles divided the city into square or rectangular blocks. Within each block were several houses. The blocks were further divided by lanes. Each lane had a public well. Most of the houses had each a private well. Houses were big or small according to the need. Some houses were also 2 or 3 storied. One of the interesting features of the houses is the open courtyard. The rooms were arranged on the 3 sides of the courtyard. The entrances to the houses were in narrow lanes. The reason of not opening towards the street must have been attempt to stop dirt to enter the house or rooms, and also for privacy and safety. There were no windows at all. The doorways were very low. The doors were made where walls ended and not between the walls. Doors and the roof were made of wood. The walls were quite thick so that the rooms might be kept cool. The walls of the houses are devoid of any decoration. Common walls were rare. Some houses were separated from the others by at least a foot of space between the walls. The upper stories in the houses were reached by staircases. These staircases were solid. It appears that usually cooking was done in the courtyard, but the side room also provided for the kitchen. The kitchens had raised platforms. The buildings were built by burnt bricks. Burnt bricks were of various sizes. The standard size used for constructing houses was 27.9 into 12.7 into 6.3 centimeters. The floor was made of bricks, chalk and clay, etc. The walls were thick and built of bricks and plastered, so they withstood the ravages of time. Thus, the technique of brick making had been perfected to a high standard. Bricks were made for covering the drains. Wedge-shaped bricks were made for lining the walls. Page 37. The bathrooms in the houses were built near the streets. It had a sloping paved roof so that the water could flow into the underground drains automatically. Both the cities, Harappa and Mohenjo-daro, had a citadel or an acropolis each. It was probably occupied by the ruling class. Rectangular in shape, the citadel was formed of an artificial platform about 12 to 16 meters high. On top of the citadel is a group of buildings for public purposes. There is fortification all around the citadel. Below the citadel lay the streets and houses of the people. The towns in Indus Valley Civilization were established at the banks of the river. Harappa and Mohenjo-daro were situated on the banks of River Ravi and Indus respectively. So dams were built on the rivers to ensure the safety of the town. Drainage system. The drainage system of Indus Valley Civilization was excellent. It was a well-planned and hygienic drainage system, which was almost as good as that of the modern cities. Till the rise of ancient Rome, no other city in the world had such a developed drainage system. The drains were all covered with slabs. All pits and drains were regularly checked. Every house had a bathroom near the street in order to dispose the water easily. The drains from the individual houses were connected to the street and main drains, and the water was carried away from the city. The main drains even had manholes for inspection and clearance. Each house had a sink. In the floor of the kitchens, some pottery vessels were found sunk in the floors to receive waste water. These were called soak pits. Another important feature of the drainage system was pottery and stoneware pipes being used, which were fitted both vertically and horizontally. The drain channels were covered by loose bricks, which could be removed whenever it was necessary. Thus, a brick-lined channel flowed down every street and sometimes in small lanes into this tributary drain from the houses on either sides of the road. Page 38. The Indus Valley people had excellent supply of water. Every house contained its own brick-lined wells. Some wells have been found at some of the houses of Mohenjo-daro, but no such wells have been found at Harappa. Some of the wells built 1,000 years ago are in perfect working order up to the present day. It speaks about the technical perfection of the builders. Public buildings. Apart from ordinary houses, there were public and government buildings also. One such building was the great path found at Mohenjo-daro during excavations. Historians believe that this pool had religious significance, and on various sacred festivals people used to have a dip here. This pool has steps to reach water. Around the pools there were rooms. There is a well near the pool to fill the water in the pool. The other huge buildings found in Harappa and Mohenjo-daro were the granaries. This was used for loading grains and distributing it by government officers. In Lothal, dockyard was discovered. It is an area which docks and equipment for building and repairing ships. It could accommodate several ships at a time. The pillared hall found at Mohenjo-daro was perhaps an assembly hall or a meeting hall where people used to assemble for state business. Thus, the fine drainage system, careful planning of the town, and well-arranged water supply clearly show that every required step was taken to make the citizen comfortable. No such arrangements were available elsewhere. Even the street light system and watch and ward system at night also existed to avoid danger. The people in towns were also not allowed to throw the waste matter in the lane or along the street. They had to throw at a particular place fixed for collecting it. Page 39. Thus, the systematic way in which the cities were laid out tells that it was methodically planned and not just built haphazardly. Whosoever looked after the town arrangements, whether an individual or a committee of men, must have been thoroughly competent. Question 2. Explain the causes for the decline of Mauryas. Answer. The following were the causes for the decline of Mauryas. A. Ashoka's religious activity. Ashoka's Buddhist policies and his stress on principle of Ahimsa, his anti-Brahmin policies, were the reasons for his downfall, says R. D. Banerjee. He abandoned Digvijaya and embraced Dhamma Vijaya. He forbade animal sacrifices, hunting, killing of animals for the royal kitchen. All these measures enraged Brahmins, as it was a source of income by performing these rites. All such ideals practiced by Ashoka led to the decline of the Mauryas. B. Romila Thapar says that the organization of administration and the conception of the state were of great significance in the causes of the decline of the Mauryas. Mauryan bureaucracy might have saved the situation and prevented the disintegration of the empire if it had been of a different nature. The administration was centralized with the higher functions under the direct control of the king. In such a situation, the weakening of the central control leads automatically to a weakening of the administration. With the uneven quality of successors after Ashoka's death, there was a weakening at the center. C. Weak successors of Ashoka. Ashoka's successors were weak, who were unfit to bear the weight of the mighty monarchy. They could not stop the disintegrating forces which were working after the death of Ashoka. This resulted in the various parts of the empire becoming independent, leading to the disintegration of the empire. D. Greek invasions. A reference to this invasion is made by Polybius and Gargi Samhita. Page 40. The failure of the Mauryan kings to check Greek invasions must have received their prestige in the eyes of the people of India, and when that was gone, the empire could not have survived for long. E. Oppressive rule of the Mauryan officials. Another cause is the oppressive rule of the officials in the outlying provinces. The people of Taxila revolted against the oppressive rule of the officials during the rule of Bindusara and Ashoka. The people said they were not opposed to the king, but were opposed to the ministers who were tyrannizing over them. F. Dr. Romila Thapar points out that the other factors contributing to disintegration and lack of national unity were the ownership of land and the inequality of economic levels. As land was in the possession of the king, it could change hands more easily. G. Dr. D. N. Jha says that the decline was largely due to the economic consequences of Ashoka's policy. After the Kalinga War, Ashoka did not fight any wars, and army was used for public spectacles and parades. The huge army became too costly to maintain. Ashoka, adding many new officers, his charitable public works only strained the exchanges. The large-scale clearing of land led to thinning of forest, which resulted in floods and damage to crops. The debasement of currency under later Mauryas indicated a depleted treasury. H. Division of Mauryan Empire. After Ashoka, the empire was divided among his sons. This division weakened the strength of the empire, resulting in its decline. I. Vastness of the empire. The Mauryan empire was very vast. To control such a vast empire during those days, when there was no transport and communication facilities, became a cause for the decline. The geographical vastness became even more difficult for the inefficient and weak rulers. This resulted in declaring independence of the feudatories. Page 41. Question 3. Describe the conquests of Harshavardhana. Answer. Harshavardhana was the greatest ruler of the Vardhana dynasty of Thaneshwar. He was hardly 16 years of age when he ascended the throne in 606 AD. He became the king as his elder brother Rajyavardhana was brutally murdered by the Gowda king Sasanka. After his accession to the throne, he was surrounded by various serious problems. Though he was quite young, he handled the affairs of the kingdom efficiently and skillfully. His most immediate and urgent problem was to recover his sister Rajeshri, who was a captive in the hands of the king of Malwa, Devagupta. He also had to punish the Gowda king Sasanka, who had murdered his brother brutally. He also had to avenge the death of his brother-in-law Grahavarman and solve the problem of Kanauj. But Harsha did not give up and paid serious attention to his difficulties. First, he decided to free Rajeshri. After his coronation, he vowed to destroy the Gowdas. He made a friendly treaty with Bhaskaravarma, who was also the enemy of Sasanka. With a big army, when he was advancing towards Sasanka, he met Bhandi in the way, who had gone with Rajyavardhana against the murder of Grahavarman. When Sasanka heard Harsha's advancement with a big army, he immediately released Rajeshri. Through Bhandi, Harsha came to know that Rajeshri had fled towards Vidyanchal. He gave the responsibility of attacking Sasanka to Bhandi and himself went to Vidyanchal to trace his sister. But Sasanka fled away to Gowda kingdom. Harsha traced his sister and saved her, who was about to commit suicide. After the death of Grahavarman, Kanauj was a state of chaos. The Kanauj throne was empty as Rajeshri had no son. The ministers of Kanauj and Thaneshwar requested him to merge Kanauj and Thaneshwar. He rejected it but later agreed on the request of his sister. After both the places were merged into one kingdom, the power of Harsha enhanced. Later, Harsha transferred his capital from Thaneshwar to Kanauj. Page 42. War with Sasanka. Harsha was anxious to avenge his brother-in-law's death and made an alliance with Bhaskaravarman. Though Sasanka was defeated, he ran away from the grip of Harsha. He remained a constant trouble to Harsha. It was after his death in 620 AD that Harsha and Bhaskaravarman divided his empire between themselves. Conquest of Vallabhi. Vallabhi was a powerful state during the reign of Harsha. Its ruler was Dhurvasena II. Though Harsha defeated him, later he established friendly relations with Dhruvasena on the request of Dadda II of Brauch and married his daughter with Dhruvasena. War against Pulakeshi II. After completing the conquest of North India, Harsha devoted his attention towards conquering the Deccan. In South, Pulakeshi II of the Badami Chalukyan dynasty was the most powerful leader. A fierce battle took place in 635 AD, but Harsha was defeated. His army was crushed badly and returned to North India, dejected and disappointed. Pulakeshi assumed the title of Parameshwara after defeating Harsha. Conquest of Ganjam. Harsha wanted to conquer the province of Ganjam, but due to his enmity with Sasanka, he had failed to capture it. After repeated attempts, he finally conquered it in 643 AD. Conquest of Sindh, Kashmir and Nepal. Various historical sources say that Harsha conquered Nepal. Yun Sang, the Chinese traveller, writes that Sindh was a powerful state. As Prabhakara Vardhana was not having friendly relations with Sindh, there were chances that Harsha might have conquered it. Page 43. Conquest of Kongoda. Kongoda is situated on the south of Mahanadi. Yun Sitang informs that Harsha conquered the province of Kongoda and Orissa when he went to Kamarupa on the invitation of Bhaskar Varman. Relations with China and Persia. Harsha was an able diplomat. He maintained friendly relations with China and Persia. There was an exchange of ambassadors and precious gifts with these two countries. Thus, Harsha was not only a successful conqueror who gave political unity to India, but also encouraged religious and cultural activities during his reign. Harsha was a worshipper of Lord Shiva and Surya, but later he inclined towards Buddhism. He was very much influenced by his brother, who was also followed Buddhism. He was a follower of Hinayana Buddhism, but later on, owing to Yun Sitang's influence, he joined the Mahayana Buddhism. Like Ashoka and Kanishka, he adopted all ways and means to spread Buddhism. He prohibited the killing of animals and practice of eating meat. He constructed several hospitals, rest houses, monasteries and stupas. Every year he summoned the Buddhist monks in an assembly. He rewarded the learned and virtuous and excommunicated the corrupt monks from the Sangha. Harsha is the only king in history who is credited with convocation of large public assemblies at regular intervals for religious and cultural purposes. Harsha summoned an assembly at Kanauj to spread the teachings of Buddha in the country. A large number of kings, Hinayana and Mahayana Buddhist monks, and Brahmanas and Buddhist scholars from Nalanda University attended it. Harsha proposed Yun Sitang to the chair and prescribed for a discussion on topic on Mahayana. This meeting lasted for 23 days. On the closing day of the assembly, a great fire suddenly broke out in the tower and pavilion. Harsha himself intervened and brought the fire under control. Harsha exiled and arrested 500 Brahmins for this fire incident. Page 44. Harsha called another assembly at Prayag and invited Yun Sitang to participate, who had prepared to travel back to China. The ceremony began with the worship of Lord Buddha, Shiva and Surya. Various gifts were distributed to the poor and needy. Each Buddhist monk was given 100 pieces of gold, one pearl, one cotton garment, various drinks, flowers and perfumes. Though Harsha was a staunch follower of Buddhism, he tolerated all religions. He encouraged all religions. Harsha also encouraged literature. He himself was a great scholar who wrote three dramas, Priyadarshika, Ratnavali and Nagananda. Many great poets and scholars lived in his court. Banabhatta was the chief among them. He wrote Harsha Charita and Kadambari. The other scholars in the court were Jayasena, Bhartrihari, Divakar and Matanga. It is said that he used to spend 1/4 of his income for encouraging scholars. Harsha also encouraged the expansion of education. Nalanda was a great center of higher education. Harsha patronized it liberally. He donated 100 villages to Nalanda. Many scholars agree that he was one of the greatest kings that India has produced. He was a great conqueror, an efficient administrator. He was himself a scholar and encouraged learned people. He also encouraged education. Question 4. Write a note on the Sangam literature. Answer. The age of the Sangam is the age to which the Sangam literature belonged. This age has been called as the Golden Age of Tamil culture. Sangam is a Sanskrit word which means association. It was a literary academy of scholars and poets who flourished for a time under the patronage of Pandya kings. It was a college or group of Tamil poets. Page 45. According to Tamil tradition, there were three Sangams. The first Sangam lasted for 4,440 years under the patronage of 89 Pandya kings. It was attended by gods and other legendary sages. Saint Agastya was its president. The second Sangam was established at Kapatapuram or Alovai by Agastya. It lasted for 3,700 years and was patronized by 59 Pandya kings. There were nearly 3,700 poets. The third Sangam was founded in present Madurai. It existed for 1,850 years and patronized by 49 Pandya kings. The Tamil literature of the Sangam period are classified into two groups, Agam and Puram. Agam poetry or love deals with the eternal. It deals with the inner inspiration of which has been realized. Param deals with the external. It deals with the virtues of heroism, self-sacrifice, generosity, simplicity, and the misery of life from birth to death. The great grammatical work Tolkappiyam, Pattu Pattu, the 10 poems, 2 Tamil epics, 18 minor works, Ittuoygai, 8 anthologies belong to the Sangam age. There are other works which have completely or mostly perished. The earliest surviving Tamil work is Tolkappiyam, written by Tolkappiyar, who was one of the disciples of Saint Agastya. It is a work on grammar. The Sila Padikaram was the earliest and the greatest of the epics of the Sangam age. It was written by Ilango Vadigal. It is a tragic story of a merchant, Kovalan, who fell in love with a dancer, Madhavi, and neglected his wife, Kannagi. She revenges the death of her husband at the hands of the Pandya king and became a goddess. It marks the beginning of the Kannagi cult, which was called after her name, Pattini cult, which is the worship of Kannagi as the ideal wife. The Manimekhalai was written by Sattanar of Madurai. It is a story of Manimekhalai, the daughter of Kovalan and Madhavi of the earlier epic. The author describes how Manimekhalai preserved and protected her chastity from Prince Udaykumaran and became a Buddhist nun to preach its doctrine. Page 46. Tirukural or Kural was written by Tiruvalluruvar. It is known as the Bible of the Tamil land. The Ittuoygai consists of 8 anthologies. It consists of 2,282 poems attributed to more than 200 authors. It is a collection of the Agam or love poems dealing with various aspects of love and Puram style of literature. The Pattu Pattu or 10 Ideals are long poems. Poems contain verse lines varying from 100 to 782 in number. The Madurai Kanji is the longest poem, having more than 700 lines, written by Mangudi Maduram. It contains the advice given by Mangudi Manduram to a Pandya king. The poem reveals the truth about the temporal nature of victory, fame, and happiness. These are not eternal and cannot be believed as permanent. 3 poems, Mullai Pattu, Pattini Pallai, Nettunnalattai deal with both Agam and Puram aspects. Question 5. Write a note on the art and architecture of Cholas. The Cholas developed the Dravidian style of Pallavas and perfected it. They were great builders and executed works on a large scale. A new development which modified the Dravidian architecture in later times was the addition of a huge gateway called Gopuram. The Chola architecture has been appreciated for the purity of its artistic traditions. Building of huge and grand temples and Sri Chakras are their specialities. Their temples have Garbhagruha, Mahamantapa, Ardhamantapa, Nandimantapa and Vimanas. The temple of Koranagantha at Srinivasanallur is an example of early temple architecture of Cholas. It belongs probably to Parantaka I. It consists of Garbhagriha and the attached Mandapa. A salient feature of this temple is that it has full-length images of Hindu gods and goddesses on the wall surfaces of the Vimana installed within recesses. This heralds a new phase in the development of Dravidian temple style under Cholas. Page 47. The Brihadeshwara, also known as the Rajarajeshwara temple at Tanjore, was built by Raja Raja in 1010 AD. It has a shikhara consisting of 14 successive stories rising to a height of 190 feet. It is the tallest shikhara in India. The temple consists of Nandi pavilion, a pillared portico and a large assembly hall. The sculpture of Dwarapalikas attract the attention of the people. The temple at Gangaikonda Cholapuram, built by Rajendra Chola, has a 160 feet high shikhara. The temple is within an inverse walled quadrangle. It consists of a large mantapa, vimana and a vestibule. The other important temples were the Subramanya temple of Tanjore, the Airavateshwara temple at Dharasuram, the Kampahishwara or the Tajabhuvaneshwara temple at Taibhuvanam. In the Dasuram temple, one of the mantap as designed in the shape of a chariot drawn by elephants. Sculpture. Cholas attained great skill in the casting of metal icons. Portraits, icons and decorative sculpture are the main classes of Chola sculpture. Among the icons, Shaiva figures predominate as Cholas were Shaiva followers. However, there are some Vaishnava and Jaina images. There are portraits of men and women in the Nageshwara temple at Kumbakonam. The Shiva temple at Tiruvailiswaram is a museum of superb early Chola iconography. In the niches of the panjars of its Vimana and the recesses between them, there are magnificent sculptures of Shiva in various forms. The other interesting early Chola sculptures are the relief of 8-armed Durga with 2 devotees kneeling on either side and a group of Vishnu and his consorts from Dhruvan temple of Vishnu at Olagopuram, South Arcot. The walls of the temples of Brihadeshwara and Gangaikonda Cholapuram contain numerous icons of large size and forceful execution. The Nataraja image in its various forms holds the first place among the Chola bronzes. The Nataraja in the Nageshwara temple is one of the largest and finest images known. One of the left hands holds the fire which animates and devours the world in its cosmic whirl. One of the god's feet is crushing a titan, for this dance is danced upon the bodies of the dead. One of the right hands is making the gesture of reassurance, that is Abhaya Mudra. Page 48. Painting. Of the paintings, the most important are those in the Pradakshina Patha round the sanctum of the Tanjore temple belonging to the time of Rajaraja I and Rajendra I. The theme of the Tanjore paintings is religious. The episodes of the life of Sundaramurtis form the object of some of the best panels. On the top of the panel, on the west wall, is the Kalidasa scene with Shiva seated in Yogasana on a tiger skin, with the Nandi in front and a group of rishis with a couple of Apsara maidens dancing at the opposite end. Tripurantaka panel on the north wall is the grandest composition. It is a battle scene and Shiva is standing on the deck of the chariot with 8 arms carrying different weapons. On the driver's seat is the 4-headed Brahma. In front are the horses of the Asuras facing Shiva and his Ganas. On the top is seen Durga on her lion thrusting a sphere into the body of Asura, while her lion is holding another by the neck. Section D. Answer any 3 of the following. 3 multiplied by 5 equal to 15 marks. Question 1. Explain the causes for the decline of the Harappan civilization. Answer. In the absence of any written material or historical evidence, scholars have made various speculations regarding the causes for the decline and destruction of the Harappan culture. A. Foreign invasions. The occurrence of some human skeletons in the habitation area at Mohenjo-daro, including one of which the skull bears the mark of a cut, has been interpreted as evidence of a massacre at the hands of the invading Aryans. This view is put forth by Mortimer Wheeler and Child. B. Heavy floods. There is some evidence of devastation by floods at Mohenjo-daro and Harappa. As these cities were on the banks of rivers, they would have been flooded. Researchers say that Mohenjo-daro city was built 7 times. Page 49. C. Geographical changes. Over-exploitation of the land led to the decrease in rainfall. This might have turned the lands barren and into desert. D. Earthquakes. The civilization might have been destroyed by earthquakes. E. The drifting of the Indus River away from the cities might have rendered the place unfertile. The rivers must have changed their course and ruined the city. F. Spread of epidemics must have copped out the population. G. Wheat revolution. H. Recent researches have shown that the decline was not sudden but gradual. Maybe an account of large-scale deforestation leading to frequent floods and consequent ecological imbalance. Question 2. Buddhist councils. Answer. These were convened by the compilation of teachings of Buddha and to settle important religious issues relating to the Buddhist Sangha. 4 councils were held at different times. A. The first council, 483 BC. It was held after a few days after the death of Buddha at Rajagriha under the auspices of King Ajatashatru. The council was presided over by Mahakasapa. Over 500 monks representing the local sanghas assembled here. Some of the prominent disciples of Buddha such as Upali, Ananda, etc. were present in this meeting. The main aim of this council was to compile the teachings of Buddha. This council gave a definite shape to the teachings of Buddha. The Vinaya Pitaka and the Sutta Pitaka were written. The Vinaya Pitaka deals with the discipline of the monks, rules and regulations that should govern the Sangha. The Sutta Pitaka summarizes the teachings of Buddha. These texts were accepted as authoritative religious texts of Buddhism. Page 50. B. The Second Council, 383 BC. It was convened at Vaishali 100 years after the death of Buddha. This council was attended by delegates from all parts of the country. It was held under the patronage of Kakavarnin. The council took stock of the various practices which were contrary to the rules of Vinaya Pitaka. No agreement could be reached. The split occurred into 2 groups, Mahasanghikas and Sthavira Vandins. Those who broke away and followed new practices were called Mahasanghikas. Those who observed the traditional rules and wanted to follow the same as laid down in the Vinaya Pitaka came to be called as the Sthavira Vandins. C. The Third Council, 251 BC. It was held during the reign of Ashoka at Pataliputra. This conference was presided over by Mogali Puttathisa. This conference was convened to clarify the divergent claims about the teachings of Buddha. Ashoka contributed much for the spread of Buddhism in India and outside through Dharma Matras. The council produced a new book, Abhidhamma Pitaka, containing philosophical interpretation of Buddhist doctrines and finally settled the religious literature of Buddhists. The council also sought to eliminate the disruptive tendencies and made all efforts to bring about split in the Buddhist church as punishable. D. The fourth council, 85 AD, was held during the time of Kanishka at Kashmir. It was presided over by Vasumitra, and Ashwaghosha, the famous scholar, acted as its vice president. The council was convened to settle some of the differences of opinion between the Buddhists. But this council failed to achieve its main objective of keeping the Buddhists united, and it split into two sects, Mahayana and Hinayana. These councils became a means also to spread Buddhism within and outside India. Page 51. Question 3. Gandhara art. Gandhara was a region during the Kushana period where many civilizations of Asia and Europe interacted with each other. It was a meeting place of Indian culture from east and the Greek, Roman, Persian and Shaka cultures from the west. Gandhara remained in direct links with the Greeks for a long time due to Alexander's invasions, Bactrian, Shakas, Pallavas and Kushana rule. As a result of this contact, a style of art developed here known as the Gandhara art. The centers of this art were Taxila, Purushapura and neighboring places. Probably, this art originated in 2nd century BC and reached its zenith in the reign of Kanishka. The subjects of this art are Indian, while the technique is Greek. Therefore, it is also called as Indo-Greek, Indo-Bactrian, Indo-Hellenic, Indo-Roman, Greco-Roman or Greco-Buddhist art. But on the basis of geography, it is called Gandhara art. This school is closely associated with Mahayana school of Buddhism. Before the rise of this branch, the Buddhists took Buddha as a great man and not as a reincarnation of God. That is why his statue was not worshipped. But with the origin of Mahayana, the idol worship began. Many scholars think that the statues of Buddha were first made in Gandhara, so the importance of this art increases all the more. The main subject of this art is the life of Buddha and the 61 events of his life. The artists of this school did not work on symbols of Buddha like his footprint, a vacant seat, an umbrella. Instead, the pictures of Buddha were carved. They used elaborate drapery, dresses and ornaments. He has been shown with locks of hair. Heavy clothing have been shown. The clothes and ornaments on Buddha's statues are not Indian. Most statues are fleshy, with thick lips and extended eyes. As this art is a mixture of Indian, Iranian, Greek and Roman arts, the statues of Buddha resembles that of the Greek god Apollo. Page 52. In place of showing him in the Asana Mudra, he has been shown atop a throne. In some he has been shown wearing chappals. The pieces of sculpture were also better polished and finished. The statues were made of grey stone. Some were also made of plaster, stucco, clay and terracotta. The statues of this school are found in the museums at Lahore, Taxila and Peshawar. The Bodhisattva statue in the Lahore Museum is quite beautiful. The statue in Berlin Museum showing a dhyana pose of Gautam Buddha is renowned for its calm and cool countenance. Stupas were also made in this style. These were built over platforms with a chhatra over them, which added largely to their height. Being influenced by foreign art, these statues lack the spiritual dimension. Indian artists expanded upon the emotional and spiritual aspects of sculpture. The Greeks stressed on the precision and the physical beauty. Had these statues been made in Indian style, the hair would not have been shown on Buddha's head because in India, sannyasis used to cut their hair. Scholars hold varied views as to whether or not this art was superior or not. The ideals which the artists cherished could not be embodied in the Gandhara art. The statues of Buddha made here lacked spiritual dimension. Question 4. Narasimha Varman 1. Answer. From 630 to 668 AD, it was the greatest of the Pallava rulers. He was the son and successor of Mahendravarman I. His achievements were so great that he became supreme in the whole of South India. After coming to power, he wanted to avenge the insult of his father at the hand of Pulakeshi II. He had fully prepared to take revenge on Pulakeshi II. During his rule, also Pulakeshi II attacked Kanchi. But Narasimha Varman I defeated Pulakeshi II in three battles, Pariyala, Manimangala and Suramara. The Pallava army pursued the Chalukyas and entered Badami. In one of the battles, Pulakeshi II lost his life also. Page 53. Narasimha Varman I occupied Vatapi or Badami, the capital of Pulakeshi II, in 642 AD. He assumed the title of Vatapi Konda, that is, captor of Vatapi, and Mahamalla, the great warrior. Narasimha Varman I also had a powerful fleet. He sent two naval expeditions to Ceylon and helped Manavarma, the Ceylonese prince, to ascend the throne. The first expedition was a failure, whereas the second had tremendous success. Narasimha Varman I was a great patron of art. He built a sea beach town called as Mammalapuram or Mahabalipuram. Most of the temples built by him are found here. He erected monolithic shrines known as the Rathas at Mahabalipuram, later called the Pagodas. The Chinese pilgrim Yuan Sang visited Kanchi in 640 AD during the rule of Narasimha Varman I. He gives a valuable account about the Pallava kingdom. He says, Kanchi was about 6 miles in circumference. There were more than 100 Buddhist monasteries and more than 10,000 monks lived there. The people here loved learning. There was a large monastery near the south of the capital. The Dharmapala of the Nalanda University belonged to Kanchi. Thus, his political achievements made him supreme sovereign in South India. Question 5. Alvars. One of the cultural contributions of South was in the form of Bhakti cult. Bhakti means complete devotion and surrender to personal God. The individual's faith in and devotion to personal God is interpreted as a means of attaining salvation. The Bhakti movement, which has in its genesis the worship of the gods Shiva and Vishnu, had its beginning in the South. Shaiva and Vaishnava saints of the South developed the Bhakti cult considerably. The Shaiva saints were known as Alvars. In praise of their own god Vishnu, they composed poems and songs and gradually developed their own popular devotional literature called Sangam classics. Page 54. Alvar means one in deep wisdom. Side by side with the Shaiva saints, Alvars also flourished and worked along the same lines for the revival of Hinduism in the South. Alvars flourished between 500 to 850 AD. The Alvar saints hailed from the Pallava, Chola, Chera and Pandya countries. These saints were from all classes, castes and various strata of society: kings, princes, Brahmins, robbers, peasants, etc. The 4,000 hymns of Vaishnava saints are collected in the Nalayira Prabandham. These hymns are recited even today in temples. There were 12 prominent Alvars. Some of them are Poyaki, Pudam and Peyalvar, were probably the earliest Vaishnava saints. Poyaki was born at Kanchi, Pudam at Mallai and Peyalvar at Mylapore. A legend tells us that once these three saints took shelter in a small narrow room when there was a heavy rainfall. It could only just hold them standing in darkness while God Vishnu came to them seeking their company. When they became conscious of him, a blazing transcendence lifted them up from their normal consciousness and gave them the voice of poetry, atonance. Since then, they began to express their ecstatic thoughts in verses. Their bhakti to Vishnu was simple, gentle, and of unflinching devotion. They flourished not later than the 5th or the 6th century AD. Tirumalisai was born in a village of that name in Chingalpet district in south. He was probably contemporary of the Pallava king Mahendravarma I. It is said that he practiced Buddhism, Jainism and Shaivism. Finally, he became a Vaishnava saint. He was uncompromising in his monotheism. Thus, he was a militant Vaishnavite. He has written Nammu Gantiru Vandadi and Tiruchanda Viruttam. Tirumangai was one of the most famous Vaishnava saints. He was petty chieftain of Alinadu in the Tanjore district. He flourished in 8th century. A legend tells us that he became a highway robber to kidnap and marry the daughter of a Vaishnavite doctor of higher caste for whom he changed his religion. Page 55. It is said that he stole a solid gold image of Buddha from a monastery at Nagapattinam to pay the expenses of a renovation of the Vaishnava temple of Sri Rangam. He composed many hymns and attacked Jainism and Buddhism. His hymns and poems are of good quality. Periyalvar is also known as the Vishnu Chittar and Bhattar Piran. He was a Brahmin of Srivillar Puttar. He won a religious debate in the court of the Pandya king Srimara Srivallabha. He composed hundreds of songs, 500 of which are available to us. These are known for their descriptive power and earnestness. He wrote Tirumoli, an imaginative recreation of Lord Krishna's life. Andal Goda. Periyalvar found a child at the foot of a tree while digging in his garden. He named the child Andal and brought her up. Some say that Andal was his real daughter. Andal was a gifted woman. In her intense devotion to the divine, she dreamt as one of Lord Krishna's gopis, sought him with singular fervor and unflinching determination. At last, she achieved union with him at Sri Rangam. She claimed that the Lord of Sri Rangam was her lover, and her poems are infused by her passionate longing for companionship with her Lord. She composed songs and hymns which are filled with allusion to Lord Krishna's stories. She wrote two books, Natchachiyar Tirumoli and Tirupavai. She is one of the greatest mystic women of the world. She is Meera of South India. The hymn of Andal, which starts with the words Varana Mariam, 1,000 elephants, telling of her dream marriage with Vishnu, is sung at all Vaishnava Brahmin marriages to this date. Tiruppan was an untouchable. He was not permitted to enter the Sri Rangan temple, but his bhakti to Lord Ranganatha was intensely profound. His 10 verses are included in the collection of hymns of Alwar saints. Tundar Dipodi was originally called Vipra Narayan. Tundar Adipodi means the dust of the feet of the devotees. He was a Brahmin from Tanjore. He was intolerant to Buddhists and Jains. His 55 hymns survive even today. Kula Shekara was the king of Travancore who was proficient alike in Sanskrit and Tamil. His god hunger was so intense that he abdicated the throne and wholly dedicated himself to the service of the divine. Page 56. He sang in his poems the glories of the shrines of Vishnu at Chidambaram and at Tiruvalli. He wrote the notable devotional poem in Sanskrit, Mukundamala, besides 105 Tamil verses forming the Perumal Tirumoli in the Tamil canon of the Vaishnavas. Nammalvar was also called Shatakopa. He was born of the Vellala family of Alvara Tirunagari in Tinnaveli district. Miran was the personal name, but on his occasion of his initiation, he was given the name Shatakopa. He renounced the world at the age of 35 years and became a yogi. His hymns are largest in number after those of Tirumangai, which embody the deepest religious experience and philosophic thought of the greatest seers of the world. These are held in high respect as these contain the deepest philosophical truths taught by the Upanishads. According to him, Jiva seeks God and would be with him because he has already chosen and is with his devotee. He sometimes compares Jiva to a lovesick maiden hungering for the divine nectar of her Lord's love. His symbolism of love is intricate and elaborate and extensive. His Nalayira Prabandham consists of the whole of the fourth part called Tiru Vayamoli and Tiru Virultam, Tiru Vasiyaram and Periya Tiru Vantadi, which are included in the third part. Tiru Vayamoli is subdivided into 10 parts, each containing 10 poems. In all, there are 1102 stanzas. His Tiru Vayamoli is filled with his mystical experience. He has handled successfully themes from the lives of Rama and Krishna. He expressed these in some very charming poetry. His poetry is encyclopedic in its mystic range. He commands a high rank as a poet saint and his philosophy. Madhura Kavi was a student of Nammalvar. He was dedicated to his guru Nammalvar. He wrote a short hymn of 11 stanzas in praise of his guru. It is even sung by Vaishnava devotees. Both Nammalvar and Madhura Kavi flourished in later half of the 9th century. With this, we come to the end of Evershine Model Paper 1.